Very hard, isn't it, to avoid the instant in an instant age. It's everywhere. Food, right there, from coffee to whole meals. Our art, the RSC do the complete works of Shakespeare in just over 2 hours. That's the reduced Shakespeare company. Work, you can go into many a bookshop and pick up the management made simple book, which turns the bumblingly incompetent vicar into an omnicompetent CEO overnight. Family life, I've got a book on my bookshelves entitled The 60-Minute Father. It was only after I bought it I discovered 60 minutes was how long it takes you to read the book, not how long it takes you to, well, you can understand the alternative. And even in religion. Last week someone gave me a copy of the 100-Minute Bible. Written, I think, with the good intention of trying to give people a chance to get the main storyline. I dipped into it. To be honest, I found it rather boring. So tonight, in the spirit of the age, let me give you the four-word Christmas. Though we won't skimp on the substance. You'll find it there in verse 14 of John chapter 1. The Word became flesh. And if those four words are to be believed, well, this is true for sure, isn't it? Christmas is shockingly personal. Christmas is shockingly personal. It brings God out of the world of ideas, a concept to discuss, argue about it. You can't find anything better to do. It brings him down to our level. Now, I know some people love ideas. Wrestling with a meta-narrative is food and drink to them. Others of us struggle with that abstract world. We like things more concrete, more able to get your hands on them. Well, those four words tell me that God is more than meta-narrative, some overarching explanation for everything. The Word, John writes, an idea. Actually, the big idea behind the whole world, the Word became flesh. An idea with skin on. As a person, not an idea. Christmas is shockingly personal. It changes all the talk about God. John has been going on about people rejecting or receiving the Word. And now we discover it's not an idea you're throwing in the bin. It's a person I'm kicking in the teeth. It's not a philosophy to live by. It's a person to walk with me through life. The Word became flesh. Four simple words. But look at the shock they held. Yeah, a person, not an idea, and an at-my-level person, not out of my reach. And yet you see how he began the chapter. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. And that Word stepped into the world he had made. I don't know whether you ever saw that television program. I think it was called Back to the Floor. They took a manager and put him on the shop floor for a week. The one I saw was they had the owner of one of those refuse disposal companies, as they call it, on the truck driving around the streets of Westminster. He was collecting the rubbish. He faced the pressures, the schedules, the dirt, the filth, the abuse. He had the driver shouting at him for a whole week. The Word became flesh for a lifetime. Actually, an eternity as a human being. Why? When London won the 2012 Olympic bid, at the final conference, they took a number of star name athletes out there to promote the bid. And I remember reading Matthew Pinsent to writing an article in the Times shortly afterwards, just describing an hour or two he had alongside David Beckham. They just walked from the conference centre into the coach and driven back to a hotel. Pinsent was just dumbfounded by the frenzy around Beckham. People grabbing at him, desperate to get his autograph, and finally they got on the coach, and Pinsent had the inside seat next to Beckham, and they both kind of collapsed, Beckham by the window, and thought they could relax safe on the coach, but next moment there are faces at the window, people lifting them up, knocking on it, scrabbling, desperate for any attention from Beckham, and Pinsent's no stranger to publicity. He is, after all, the four times Olympic gold medalist rower. And he said to David Beckham, "Is it always like this?" And Beckham said, "All the time. Public property. But they're to be gawked at, ogled." Hey, listen to this. Here's John writing a little later on. "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we've looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim, containing the word of life." Handle, touch. Same sense of being there on display, public property. If I were God, I would have guarded my privacy better, wouldn't you? Christmas is shockingly personal. The word became flesh. And I'm wondering why. A person, not an idea, an at-my-level person, and there is more to it than just became human. That word flesh is starker, it's more shocking than that. In the Latin translation, they use the word carne. Sounds clever to know that. I only know it because Paul Blackham told me. And he only knows what it means because he's eaten chili con carne. Chili with meat. The word became meat. Put it that way, and you get something of the shock. Any Greek reader of John's Gospel would have been wincing. See, they love to divorce the spiritual from the body. Well, God united them at Christmas. Some Eastern religions today, some Western ideas of spirituality, often have a kind of spiritual side of me, as if it's separate from the physical side of me. At Christmas, God stepped into a body, not out of it. The Word became flesh. Here's a Christmas shock for a world fixated on body shape. God became flesh, experienced ugliness. His appearance was disfigured. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. That's what Isaiah the prophet wrote. He wouldn't have made the cover of Hello magazine. The Word became flesh. I'm wondering why. Look how John explains it. Look down at verse 14. "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us." He wanted to live among us, be at home with us, relate to us. It's kind of got the sense of pitched his tent among us. Only don't think of a camping weekend. Literally, it's tabernacled, which is a word that won't mean much to many. But if you know your Old Testament scriptures, it was the word used way back when the people of God were nomadic, living in tents, and the tabernacle was the special tent that stood for God's presence with his people. Now, if you've got a God, you almost always have a God place, a holy place. You often identify a religion with a place. We rarely think of a tabernacle, but a temple, a cathedral, a shrine. Well, John says, no canvas here. No tent pegs, no guy ropes. If you're going to put up a blue plaque, "God lived here," don't put it on a wall. You've got to put it on a person. The baby who became a boy, who grew up into a man. The Word became flesh. Christmas is shockingly personal. Points to this Jesus, for that's who John's talking about, and says, there's God. With embarrassing humility, God comes all the way down to my level and says, here I am. A flesh and blood Word for a flesh and blood world. There's a church up in Glasgow, that every Thursday night does what we do every Saturday night, and he goes on a soup run to try and help the homeless around the city centre there. A friend of mine joined them just before Christmas the other year, and he said that they set off and they visited hostels and people living rough on the streets under flyovers and so on, and they gave each one a hot drink, some soup, sandwiches, and a Christmas present. There's a businessman there called Wally who apparently leads the team, and for over 15 years he had not missed a single Thursday night to be involved in the work. My friend told me it was about 3 o'clock in the morning when they found the drunk lying on the grating near a department store. And Wally went up to him and shook him and obviously knew him and said, "Jock, it's Wally, I've some food for you." But there was no response. So eventually, Wally lay on the ground next to Jock, spoke face to face with the man, gave him some hot chocolate, put the prezi and the sandwiches in his overcoat pocket. There's a thumbnail picture of Christmas for you. God could have ignored us. Just as Wally could have chosen to stay at home in the warm with his feet up and the telly on any Thursday night. Instead, God came down to my level, in Jesus, to know me, to relate to me. The Word became flesh. There's an awful lot packed into those four words, isn't there? Christmas is shockingly personal. And when John speaks of rejecting or receiving the Word, it's this one who put the universe together, breathes life into us, sheds light into our darkness. It's this one who now stepped right down into our world. That's the one he's talking about. The Word became flesh. And actually, there's something more to those four words. They tell us Christmas is shockingly personal. But they also tell us Christmas is wonderfully revealing. Wonderfully revealing. I don't know that Christmas can ever be sort of sepia-tinted in the memory, but it can kind of have snow-tinted nostalgia attached, can't it? I mean, it's all very well talking this way, but we weren't there, were we? It was before our time. I mean, the Word became flesh, and, well, even if it happened, we can be forgiven for thinking God's still a bit of a mystery shrouded in fog for us. Feels as if it's still down to guesswork at times. And that's why John carries on the way he does. Did you notice? The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. See how verse 14 goes on? We have seen, says John. See, the New Testament's a record of those who were there, who did see, hear, handle, touch. There's a New Testament's a record of those who can tell us. It's why you'll find we keep on opening it here at All Souls, because you really don't want to hear my foggy guesswork about God. We have seen his glory. The glory of the one and only who came from the Father. This is the real McCoy, the one and only. No one else is going to come and give me another slant on God, be a divine light for some other age. So what is he like? You're lying in the gutter. You come to. You feel in your pockets. You unwrap the present. And you discover full of grace and truth. Astonishing combination. Truth. I think as a society we struggle with truth, don't we? We alternate from no such thing to I'd love to get my hands on it if only I could know the truth. We seem to forget it could be both very real and very depressing. You want to know what God is really like? What if he turns out to be the kind of God who is so utterly holy he can't stand any failure? Intimacy is not very reassuring then, is it? I'd rather he stayed remote. The Word became flesh would be a terrifying four words, if that were true. And when Jesus comes as a human being, see, I am face to face with the truth about God as He really is, and I can't live with that holier God. We have all stood, haven't we, where the woman caught in adultery stood. Now, I don't mean we're all adulterers, but we all know what it is to have been exposed. To have been in the wrong, done wrong, deserving the judgment that's coming to us. Now, truth is all very well, but there is a truth I can't live with, and neither can you. A truth I've got to run from and pushes me away. Belle Mooney, the journalist, did a radio series entitled Devout Skeptics, in which she interviewed a number of people. One of them was Philip Pullman, the author of the trilogy His Dark Materials. And here's a little snippet of the conversation she had with him. Belle Mooney said, "When I finished The Amber Spyglass, one of the trilogy, one of the many things I thought was, Philip Pullman obviously hates the church. But all the clerics I meet are decent bearded chaps in the half-empty churches doing good works and bringing comfort to pensioners. They're not burning witches." Pullman says, "Not anymore. So you can relax. They wouldn't get away with it now." And Mooney goes on, "But they wouldn't want to." "No," says Philip Pullman, "not the nice gentle ones who have half-empty churches. But the ones who have churches that are full," he says, "the evangelicals, the fundamentalists, are full of hellfire and damnation and fury and vengeance on anyone who disagrees with them." Well, you may recognize the church he describes. You shouldn't be able to recognize our God. Because the truth about Him includes grace. In fact, when the Archbishop of Canterbury was in conversation with Philip Pullman, one of the best things he asked him went something like this: "Why is there no trace of Jesus in your God?" Full of grace and truth. Grace isn't something you say before meals. Grace is far more than being kind. It's mercy. It's giving what is not deserved. Forgiveness instead of judgment. Hope instead of despair. Life instead of death. It's giving what's not deserved without letting go of the truth that brought judgment and despair and death in the first place. Now, we struggle to hold those two together. That was something of the dilemma that Arnold Schwarzenegger faced last week. I mean Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, not the film star, if you can separate them. He had to decide on the case of Stanley Tookie Williams. You may have heard of it. Williams was the founder of a notorious gang. He was guilty of multiple murders, brutal ones. Sentenced to death in prison, he seemed to have been rehabilitated, became the author of anti-gang books, and was even nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Lawyers appealed for mercy for him from death row. They argued he was worth more alive than dead because of his work helping youths avoid gangs. You see the dilemma the governor faces? Do I ignore the clemency appeal and execute? Justice seems very harsh. Or do I show mercy? And immediately the question that will be asked is, what does justice say then in response to brutal murders? How can justice be upheld and grace shown? Now, you and I may not have committed brutal murders. I hope not too many of us have. But you and I may not be worth more alive than dead, might we? And anyway, we cannot earn grace or mercy, as Tookie Williams discovered. Yet we struggle to hold these two together. How can God be right to put us right when we're wrong? And if you know the incident when Jesus met the woman caught in adultery, he didn't deny the truth of what she'd done. It was wrong. It was sin. It did deserve judgment. He didn't deny her grace either. Go now and leave your life of sin. Of course, it would still have been fudging the truth, wouldn't it, if the story had ended there? With a little girl on Santa's knee, and he was telling her the Christmas story of the Saviour born in a manger, and when he finished, she turned to him and said, well, how does the story end? It doesn't end, of course, before the baby in the manger has become the Christ hanging on the cross for us. Sins get their just penalty. But my just judgment is faced by an innocent other, so that I can be offered grace in spite of my treachery. Go and leave your life of sin. I mean, you must read the story for yourself, but you'll discover that's God's heartbeat, full of grace and truth. Christmas is wonderfully revealing. You can hold those together. So there you have it. Christmas in four words. The Word became flesh. Shockingly personal. All that discussion and debate over ideas about God focuses on a person. The Jesus who with breathtaking humility steps into our world to live with us, to be one of us, so that we might know him. Wonderfully revealing. Truth faced. My dark side, your dark side, are out in the open, and yet grace, pardon, life offered where only guilt and judgment are deserved. Offered at great cost to him. Grace doesn't mean there's nothing to pay. It means he picked up the tab. And John says, he, this one, was in the world. And when he came into the world, it responded in two totally different ways. Either it rejected, did not recognize, or it received, trusted him, became one of his family. The four-word Christmas. The Word became flesh. And yet it finds us all out, doesn't it? Now, the Word became flesh, but where do you stand this Christmas? When this Word, this Jesus comes before you, rejecting or receiving? Where are you when the Word become flesh is there in front of us? Stranger or family? We're all one or the other.